Welcome to the Copywriter's Cupboard podcast. Today, we'll be speaking to the former editor of the Financial Times, Andrew Gowers. Andrew read English language and literature at the University of Cambridge before beginning his career as a journalist at Reuters. He subsequently joined the Financial Times, becoming the first editor of the Financial Times Deutschland in 2000. In October 2001, he returned to London, becoming editor of the main Financial Times. And in a career that subsequently took him to Lehman Brothers and BP, he witnessed the largest financial crisis in history, and arguably the largest environmental disaster in history, firsthand. His career has given him unparalleled insights into financial writing, reputation management, and crisis communications, all of which we will be touching on today. I first met Andrew back in 2014 when he was head of corporate affairs at Trafigura, which is one of the world's largest commodity trading firms. I was on secondment to Trafigura at that time, working as a senior media relations manager, and Andrew was effectively my boss. He was, and remains, the best editor I've ever had the pleasure to work with. His approach was radically different to anything else I've experienced before or since. And that's something we're going to dig into and hopefully pick up some tips from. Over the course of his career, Andrew sat down with some major political heavyweights, including the likes of Vladimir Putin and Yasser Arafat. So I wanted to talk to him about how he prepared for interviews like that and see if there were things that we could potentially learn from him. But I also feel that we need to make a little note here. This interview with Andrew took place around 12 months ago, so that was before the current crisis in Gaza began. I believe Andrew would probably have answered some of the questions slightly differently in the light of the current context, so I feel it's only fair to him to set that out as a prefix. But in the meantime, there's still lots for us to learn here. Very exciting content. So without further ado, I introduce Andrew Gowers. Andrew, thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Would you perhaps start by telling us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you were born, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I was born in the Home Counties in England in 1957, so that makes me 65 years old. I've spent most of my life in and around London, but for the last 10 years I've been living abroad, initially in Switzerland for 6 years, where I was head of corporate affairs at Trafigura, and then subsequently I'm in semi-retirement now in Portugal, which is my country of choice.
That sounds great. And what led you initially into journalism?
Oh, I guess I always wanted to be a journalist when I got over the idea of going to the theatre, for which I was definitely not suited, but my father was a journalist, so there was a sort of path to follow. And I got into student journalism at university. I was edited the school magazine even before that. And so it seemed a natural thing to apply to one of the better training schemes out there, which was the training scheme that Reuters, graduate training scheme that Reuters ran, which was very good grounding in all sorts of journalism, including business journalism, but also gave you the opportunity to travel. So the graduate scheme at the time in Reuters was you spent up 9 months in London on various desks, and then you went straight abroad. And it took me to Brussels, and then subsequently to Zurich. And I always aspired to move beyond Reuters and work in the world of newspapers. And for my money, the best newspaper was and still is the Financial Times. So I was very pleased to have a chance to start with them in London and then work my way through various layers and reporting roles and then editing roles, and ultimately ending up as editor of the mothership in 2001.
That's fantastic. So you mentioned your father was a journalist and he worked with David Frost, didn't he? Was he actually involved in the famous Frost-Nixon interview?
No, David Frost had kind of moved beyond the world of UK TV at the time he did the Frost-Nixon. It was more of his own production, as it were. But my dad worked on a thing called the Frost Programme, which was a mixture of current affairs, satire. Some of the comedy greats worked on that show, like people like John Cleese and so forth. Some of the Pythons. And my dad was a researcher on it, which meant that he had to engage guests, research them, and get stagey confrontations on screen. Which the most famous one that he was involved in, or instrumental in, was there was a famously fraudulent insurance salesman called Savundra, and the Frost program, or my dad's. Part of the Frost program, organised to have Savundra interviewed on screen by Frost, facing an audience of people he defrauded.
Wow!
And I think he actually had to decided to leave the interview halfway through and sort of scuttle away through a stage door because it was so hostile.
Wow, that's interesting. So there would have been good dinner time conversations on
all the
background skills you needed to start your career.
All the ruses and. What's it say? You need a plausible manner, rat-like cunning, and a little literary ability, as Nick Tomlin once said about the qualifications to be a journalist.
That's a good one. Okay, so in 1977, when you were still just 19 years old, you went to Frankfurt and began work on a magazine produced by Dresdner Bank. And as ever, you seemed to have a knack for being where the action was. And you found yourself close to... one of the early events in what later became known as the German Autumn. Can you talk to that?
Yeah, so I was working in the press and information department of Dresdner Bank in Frankfurt, and it was a 9-month engagement, largely came about through nepotism because my father worked at that time at Barclays Bank, which is a kind of partner bank of Dresdner. But anyway, as that period was nearing its end, I recall being in my studio flat in Frankfurt and receiving a call on a Sunday morning saying, you need to come into the office now. And I said, why? Oh, well, the chairman, the chief executive of the bank has been shot and murdered. And it was really a shocking incident. His goddaughter got entrance to his house ostensibly to have a friendly meeting with him, but she was unbeknownst to anyone a member of the Baader-Meinhof gang, and they basically assassinated him in his study. And so we spent the whole weekend in a bank which was like an armed camp, with armed policemen on every staircase, manning the phones and basically trying to provide what information we could.
Now, this would have been doubly difficult because you were doing it in German, right?
Yeah, and I had by that time I was so immersed. I did nothing but speak German in my life in Frankfurt. I only had German speaking friends and colleagues, so I was dreaming in German by then, and on my way to being bilingual. So it really wasn't a problem.
Yeah, oh, that's good, but it must have been difficult in another sense if you're only 19, living abroad, in the height of the Cold War, and suddenly. A communist faction that assassinates your boss. How did that feel personally?
Well, I was fascinated by Germany from my school days, really. And so it was quite, thrilling at that young age to be in Frankfurt or in Germany in general. I particularly was fascinated because it seemed to me that German history was so alive and so happening before your eyes. The war was still being digested. The society had still not fully come to terms with it, but it was rapidly changing. And then you had these undercurrents of anarchist or left-wing extremists who were really expressing a sort of generational rage, even if they were not enjoying widespread support. But there was a sort of feeling that generational change needed to happen, and it was expressing itself in various ways, including that. So to me, it was like being in living history.
Yeah, which is a good place for a journalist to be, I suppose.
Absolutely.
And so the experience didn't put you off, and when you, as you said, you became editor of the Cambridge University newspaper, and you had your first main scoop there, which was on Nick Griffin. Could you talk us through that one?
Yeah, we myself and a couple of contemporaries took over the editorship, co-editorship of the student newspaper, and really had an idea of turning it into a sort of hard-hitting tabloid with very large font headlines. But one we did have one or two genuine scoops, and the one that probably stands the test of time best is having found that there was a fully paid up member of the National Front, the extreme right wing party, who's an undergraduate at Downing College. And we tracked him down. We went to his lodgings, accompanied by a snapper, a photographer, and sort of got him to come to the door, snapped his photo, and it was Downing College Nazi was the headline, something like that. So, Nick Griffin became famous subsequently because he became the leader of the National Front, and was often fighting elections. Did he stand for the European Parliament? He was one of the most well-known figures of that particular right-wing party.
Mm. But he is not the only well-known figure you've crossed, of course, during your career. You've managed to sit down with the likes of Gerhard Schroeder, Vladimir Putin, Yasser Arafat, Boris Johnson, obviously, by being a journalist, as a colleague of sorts, although albeit with a different paper. What was it like sitting down with some of those people? Those are big names. What was it like interviewing them?
It's hard to generalise. I mean, you approached each one with in the spirit of the occasion. I think the Putin one sticks in my mind, not for what was said, but for the sort of atmospherics of it. I'm always reminded of the comment that George W. Bush made after meeting Putin, saying he looked into the man's eyes and seen his soul. I looked into his eyes in this bleak office in the Kremlin and saw nothing whatsoever. And he was a guarded man with a sinister air. Each of these interviews, though, that was a staged event, was lacking in real substance. I can think now of all the things that one would have liked to have asked him, but at the time, this was the early 2000s. It was still the time when the West was kind of cautiously weighing up Putin. Is he going to carry on with some kind of democracy in Russia, or is he of a different stripe altogether? And the views tended to come out on the first of those two alternatives, which was, of course, completely wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and you also wrote a biography on Yasser Arafat. What was it like meeting him?
Well, he was a mercurial character who I was covering the Middle East for the Financial Times at the time, and with a colleague we decided to tackle this subject, mainly because everywhere you went in the Middle East and in Middle East politics at that time and for many years before, you couldn't escape him. He would sort of insert himself into every possible Middle Eastern situation in order to keep the idea of a Palestinian nation alive among the Arab states, even though the Palestinian state didn't exist. So we found that was a sort of very interesting exercise, somewhat of a theatrical exercise in a way, and therefore tried to get to the bottom of what was driving him and how he managed to keep that cause alive in unpromising circumstances for many years. So we did get to interview him a number of times. Again, very, very stagey, bizarre circumstances. One time we were staying in a hotel in Tunis for a number of weeks and seeking to make the case for this interview, and you would get these people on the phone during the day saying, yes, 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 it may happen tonight. Just stay up in your room, and if it happens tonight, then somebody will arrive in a car and take you somewhere that won't be known. And it was like, being bundled into a car at 2 o'clock in the morning, when it finally did happen after several days and nights of this, with a blindfold on, and taken to a place where we didn't know where it was, and there we were in a military style compound meeting the great man in his khaki fatigues and his keffiyeh in the shape of the map of Palestine.
Yeah.
And interviewing him was always a sort of jousting match, because he had a series of slogans and anecdotes that he would tell unfailingly. He told stories about himself that actually when it turned out, when we actually did the research turned out not really to be true, but he probably believed them by then because he told them so many times.
Yeah.
But he was, I mean, more impressive in a way than his reputation at the time or his historical memory will allow. That is to say, you know, managing that organization, or managing is perhaps not the right word, but leading in a sense that movement through the most incredible adversity and through many defeats and setbacks, he had this kind of indefatigable quality that was definitely well suited for an exile movement, and it turned out in the end not to be at all suitable for running what turned out to be a sort of local government in the West Bank and Gaza, and that's in a way his epitaph. But you know, I think he was an important figure.
Yeah, very much so. And how do you? I mean, I have two questions actually off that. One was a quick one. How much stress and danger did you feel while you were being bundled into a car with a blindfold on? How did that feel?
I treated it as all part of the fun, but I mean part of the theatre. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's got to project this image of being beyond the reach of the enemy's secret service or whatever. I mean, I doubt that he was. I imagine that the Mossad could have offed Yasser Arafat on many occasions and decided not to. But nevertheless, yeah, it was. I didn't feel any sense of sort of sense of danger, really.
Okay. And then the other question I had is, when you sit down with these big names like Putin and Arafat, how do you go about preparing an interview like that?
Well, in the case of Arafat, it was part of a process of research. So by far the most informative interviews we had were not the ones with him, but with his close colleague, and in particular a gentleman called Salah Khalaf, who was really the kind of chief ideologue and intellectual brains of the outfit. He went by the nom de guerre of Abu Iyad, and he was the progenitor and the godfather of the Black September movement, the movement that he was almost certainly the mastermind of the Munich Olympic attack in 1972. And we got close to talking about that and the sort of whys and wherefores of it. And it was a conversation that really stuck in my mind, because he was basically saying, at the Munich Olympics, you had the flag of every country on earth, and there was one flag that was missing. It was a Palestinian one, and that was there were structural reasons for that. We had to challenge it in the most shocking way possible. I mean, to say that is not to issue a defence of the action, but to place it in a context. Terrorism is rarely something that is just a sort of nihilistic expression of nothingness. It has a purpose, and in this case, it was keeping the Palestinian flag flying at a time when, in terms of territory and in terms of international recognition, they had almost nothing.
Yeah. No, I mean, if people take those kind of risks, there must be, and if it's not just a lone madman, if there are groups of them organised, then there must be something behind it, as you say. After several years of working as a journalist on the FT, you were then asked to set up the Financial Times Deutschland and to become its editor. I'm interested in that, and also in the step from moving from writer to editor. This is not always an obvious or easy step. And then you had the added challenge of doing it in your second language, in German. What was that whole experience like?
Well, first of all, moving from writer to editor, I'd made that transition some time before, just after finishing the book on Arafat. The then editor of the FT asked me to consider taking the role of what was called features editor, which was really the part of the paper that ran big pieces of analysis and comment. And so I was amazed and said yes. And that was a sort of, that was a very revealing education in where I thought, it turned out where my real strengths lay, namely in identifying topics that were interesting and making sure that pieces were written that that shed light on them in an incisive way. And I really enjoyed doing it. And nothing pleased me more than receiving an article where basically most of the facts were present, but they were utterly in the wrong order and the phrasing was terrible. And I used to say, it's all there, meaning this is not a piece I can publish, but I will take all the pieces, throw them on the floor and put them together in the right way. And out came a piece. So I really enjoyed doing that, and I still do. But anyway, when it came round to the idea of the mad idea of a German language offshoot of the FT, I had just been acting editor of the FT for a period, while the then editor Richard Lambert was launching its US edition in New York. So I kind of learned the ropes of what running a newspaper or a newsroom looks like. And when Richard came back, I remember the chief executive of the FT said to me, look, we want to do this project in Germany. The person who does this has to speak extremely good German and has to have the potential to run the FT or to experience running the FT. There is only one such person, that's you. And I couldn't resist it. I mean, it was probably mad in some ways, but there were two proper companies behind it, namely the FT owner Pearson and the German magazine and newspaper publisher Gruner & Jahr. So there was a sort of backbone behind it and money. And the brief was simply too exciting to resist, which was go to Germany, shake up the world of business journalism, which was a bit stuffy in those days and a bit reverential, hire the best journalists you can find, using the FT brand name in whatever form is appropriate, and make a new thing. It was the most thrilling and also scary experience of my life. I remember when we started, when we were just getting our feet on the ground, and word of the project had leaked, and people were writing about it. And the chief executive of Handelsblatt, which was the sort of incumbent business newspaper, said, well, this is bound to fail because it's Gruner & Jahr knows nothing about newspapers and the Financial Times knows nothing about Germany. So I thought, oh, that's a nice... I like to have somebody to be able to sort of prove them wrong.
Yeah.
And that was a big motivator. And we were able to recruit some fantastic journalists and produce a newspaper that was, and still is, actually a sort of succès d'estime. I mean, just the other day, it was the 10th anniversary of the sad decision to close it. Mm-hmm. And the decision to close it was made on the simple economic fact that it had never made a profit. So, very sadly, but people were saying, we miss it. Because it was a distinctive voice. And a modernising voice in German business journalism, and indeed in political journalism as well. And you, to sort of appreciate the quality of the people who work there, you just have to look around the world of German journalism now. The editor of Der Spiegel was a senior colleague on Financial Times Deutschland. The spokesman of Chancellor Olaf Scholz was a senior journalist on FT Deutschland. The editor of Manager magazine. Absolute roll call. Some of the top people in German journalism were cut their teeth, if you like, or got their first major exposure on that newspaper.
Yeah, and you were there managing all these superstar writers.
Yeah, and of course I was in a state of permanent necessary humility, because although I spoke in German quite well, I could never write to the standard they could in German. So it was basically. Even more than normal as an editor, I was kind of waving a baton like a conductor, but actually letting others do the playing. And I knew that I had to get out at a certain moment when it was up and running, and leave it to the domestic crew to run it. But there were enough good people to keep it going for a long time. And I think if the business model had moved with the internet. Which was the big thing that it hadn't done, it would still be alive today.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I'm going to come back to a point you've just raised in a second, but I wanted also to talk about from that point, from around 2001, you moved back to England and became the editor of the Financial Times proper, if you like, in London. that sounds like the dream role for you. Was it? What was it actually like?
Well, you know, I reflect on this. I've reflected on it long and hard over the years because my time as editor of the FT actually wasn't a happy time for me. And I think it was partly because, well, I had a falling out with the company that owned it anyway. But I think I was approaching it with perhaps a slightly misplaced mindset. In setting up Financial Times Deutschland, I was clearly an agent of change, and that's how I saw myself, and that's what it was necessary to be to succeed in it. I came back to the FT with the same mindset, and of course things need to change, but I think I was probably too impatient, and at a time when the world of newspapers was and business newspapers in particular was really being shaken by an advertising recession. This was the time of the just after 9/11, when subsequently the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and then Iraq, and there was a real shock to the world of advertising. There was basically recruitment advertising was a very strong, the largest source of revenue at the FT, and it just disappeared for quite some time. People thought maybe it won't ever come back. So we were in a paradigm adjustment after the end of the dot-com bubble. Yeah. Where people didn't really know what the future held for newspapers, so I was sort of flailing around in that challenged atmosphere, and frankly didn't really have a coherent strategy beyond the need to downsize.
Yeah, I guess no one really knew what was happening, though, did they?
Yeah, and subsequently it turned out that it was a sort of false alarm. But only by virtue of timing, because the real change to the web taking the lead and finding a model to navigate the web came a few years after that. But I guess one thing you could say is that the FT was an early mover in that and did find the right model to navigate the web. And of course now they have more than a million subscriptions, most of them principally digital ones. So people paying good money and in fact rather expensive money to read that unique content. So yeah. I think it's I feel still enormously proud and pleased to have been associated with the FT for so long. But as you premise of your initial question, I was not a happy bunny while doing that job.
Yeah, that's a shame in a lot of ways. And as I was saying earlier, some of the best editorial feedback I've ever been given has come from you, and going back to your comment about being a sort of chaperone or a conductor, whatever your word was, for guiding copy, I noticed what was really interesting about the feedback that you used to give me when you were managing me was very rarely would you use red pen, and more often would you give me almost coaching or mentoring style support in improving the article. You know, you'd say things like, I think paragraph 3 is your main point, I think you need to bring it up, I think you need to conclude with it as well. And it was more, you know, pay a bit more attention in paragraph 5 that needs tidying up, and it was more that kind of approach. How did you learn and develop that approach, and do you feel it's effective? I mean, it felt very effective to me. It felt good as a writer to get that kind of feedback rather than just red pen.
Interesting. I mean, I that's the way I consciously gravitated towards that way of doing things, because I suppose I see the job of editing as finding what's good in something you've been delivered and seeking to encourage more of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, very often, but there are, and I'll preface that also, qualify that also by saying occasionally somebody at the FT would deliver a piece to me and I thought, there is no merit in this whatsoever. I can't see anything good about it. And then I would just throw it back and say, do it again. Mm. Or come back to me when you've got a better idea.
Yeah.
But most of the time, you know, people work seriously on these articles and they get much of the way to, well, they deliver insights that you would expect from a newspaper that or a news organisation of that quality. So bring it out, emphasise it, cut out flannel. I think I've got a sort of fairly high or a fairly low tolerance for flannel and for sort of an active bullshitometer, really to try and make show off a writer in their best colours.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I know now that obviously 10 years on, more or less, a bit less, 8 or 9 years on from when we last worked together, you know, I've now moved into more of that position where I'm now helping to guide teams of writers. So this kind of insight's really helpful. What would you suggest to someone who is becoming an editor, perhaps for the first time, or like me, has been doing it for a bit longer, but how do you get the best out of teams of writers?
I think one key point is that is to make the brief as clear as you can at the outset. I mean, if somebody comes to you as an editor when they're a writer saying, I've got this piece that I need to write, the quality of the conversation at the outset is very important. And, you know, so as an editor, I think your job is to interrogate the substance of what they're trying to say, maybe issue a few challenges or flag up a few pitfalls in writing about a particular topic, or just ask sort of, you know, we used to say there's no such thing as a stupid question, there's only stupid answers.
Yeah.
Do that process of interrogation, and then you will find that somebody having a head start in terms of what they produce. And then when it comes along, be very honest. I think the idea, I saw editors in my earlier lives sometimes saying, that's great, to try and sort of, you know, to be liked, as it were. But then realizing when they actually drill into the substance of it, that there's a lot missing. Mm. And then you said this was fine. You know, writers will have their own self-esteem, and they will seek to preserve that. But if you tell them at the time, look, this is, you're halfway there, but there's loads missing, let's have a conversation about that, then there's the conversation on a different footing. But I genuinely think just taking pieces and saying, in a sort of like mechanical way, I'm going to rewrite this, you will probably lose something on the way if you do that. Well, you'll demotivate the writer, one. Yeah. Two, you'll probably miss something that would arise if you had a proper two-way conversation.
Yeah, that's great. I suppose because they may be attempting to do something that they haven't quite managed.
Right.
And that's, yeah, that's true. That's really interesting. Thank you for that. So after your period at the FT was over, after a brief stint working on the Gowers copyright review for Gordon Brown, you then joined Lehman Brothers. That was a difficult moment to join. It was a tough time because it was at the, well, it wasn't immediate, was it? But the first brewings, I suppose, of the financial crisis were beginning.
It was before that. I mean, it was really when the wave of liberal financial markets and investment bankers as masters of the universe was in full spate. This was 2006.
Yeah.
And the opportunity was Lehman was obviously a storied name with a checkered history on Wall Street, but it really seemed to be spreading its wings and doing interesting stuff internationally. And I joined Lehman in London, where the chief executive was a man called Jeremy Isaacs, and he was responsible for Europe and Asia. And it was like being handed a semi-blank sheet of paper, because it was, in effect, a new firm that had been building very fast. Mm-hmm. And my job, as I worked it out over time, was to give it a brand and a reputation internationally, which had little to do in a way with the core operation in Wall Street. So it was these were heady times, and it was a very exciting job. Once I'd worked out that there was a change of pace or a change of rhythm required when you move from journalism into a business role, that was a hard learning process. So in journalism, I realized after the fact that you get up every day, you produce an article or several articles, or you oversee the production of a whole edition, you put it to bed, and then you get up and do it again the next day. You insofar as there's a strategic content, it's almost a secondary factor. In a corporate affairs role, where you're actually trying to build a picture over time, you have to measure your successes, not in what did I create today, but what am I looking to create in 6 months or a year's time?
Yeah.
There were some sort of quite revealing conversations. The Jeremy Isaacs used to say to me, you know what, you're just too tactical. You really need to get strategic.
Right.
And so I was in listening mode, and I think I did learn a bit about that, which was to bear fruit in one or two other roles later on. As I say, Lehman was, with hindsight, one can say, well, it was all part of a big financial bubble. It was deeply involved in the subprime mortgage sector and all of that. Yes, true. When it came down to it, in 2008, it turned out there was a large hole on Lehman's balance sheet based on not marking down real estate assets as they should have been. And that was the comeuppance of the entire institution. It was an extremely interesting, educative time to be in a reasonably senior position of an institution that was kind of had walked off a cliff and didn't realize it, or thought that there was a safety net, and there wasn't. Yeah. You get insights into human mentality and behavior that way. But eventually I left the bank as it was really on the skids. I signed a compromise agreement to leave Lehman on the 12th of September 2008 at 5:20 London time, and 7 o'clock in the morning London time on the following Monday, the 15th, we all woke up and the bank was gone.
Wow. And what was that? I mean, it must have been horrendously stressful. Was it, I mean, how difficult was it to live through the eye of the storm? Because Lehman really was at the epicenter, at least of the public attention. I mean, we now know that AIG was struggling, even General Electric had problems, but Lehman was really where the public focus was.
It was an epitome in a number of ways, including that, it was allowed to fail, almost pour en courage et les autres. I mean, to show that there is not an unlimited public sector safety net under all of the highly speculative financial activities that have gone on. I'm sure that there are people who were in the leadership of Lehman Brothers, including especially Dick Fuld, who still think that was terribly unfair can't understand it. But I think it was a fact of life. I think it was Mervyn King, as governor of the Bank of England, who gave a speech only a few weeks after Lehman went bust, saying, the fact of the matter is there is a gigantic hole at the heart of the financial system in terms of misvalued assets and so forth. No government can fill that gap.
Yeah.
The market's going to have to adjust to it. And I think it was true, and I think it was Lehman's misfortune to be in that position, but it was also the leadership's folly to think that they could be saved.
Yeah. And you once told me an anecdote of how the London branch closed. I mean, when I told you my dad had worked in there in the 90s as a compliance officer, head of Europe actually at one point, and you told me that a senior person came down to reception, and I believe, did you say they stood on the reception desk to announce the closure?
No, this was, in fact, it was the Monday morning. I wasn't there because I'd as it were left the bank, but I heard this subsequently, where the whole staff were called down to the, there was an auditorium on the ground floor where they had sort of conferences and speaker events. So they summoned everybody there, and I think it was Christian Meissner, who was then co-head of investment banking, basically stood on the stage and said, it's all over, go home.
And that was it?
Yeah.
That was the closure of London?
Yeah. Well, it was the closure of the whole bank. But, there are many ironies in this. One is that, the one that I find particularly rich was that after years and years of the PricewaterhouseCoopers going through the accounts and unwinding the bank, in the European bank, they discovered that it had actually been completely solvent. In other words, once you identify the client accounts and separated them from the bank's own reserves, on paper it was solvent. The black hole was in New York,
yeah,
and it sucked in the money from London, which meant that London couldn't carry on. But every creditor of the European Lehman Brothers was paid out with interest, including me.
Wow, that's amazing.
With interest, yeah, several years later.
That's amazing. I did not know that. So you wrote a very fantastically crafted piece for The Times, which is still available online.
Sunday Times, yeah.
But it didn't reflect well on Dick Fuld, the CEO. What do you feel he did wrong?
I think he drank his own too much of his own Kool-Aid. He had become, he'd fought his way to leading the bank in various Wall Street battles over the years. He had, by the time this was happening, by the time I was there, he saw himself and was generally seen as a sort of elder statesman of Wall Street. But he was actually full of shit. I mean, the fact of the matter is, he liked to make, portentous predictions for what's going to happen. But he didn't adjust his own actions to those things as they came true. There was an event I remember because I organised it at Davos one year, the year that things started to go wrong, in which Dick Fuld sat in this lunchtime gathering with, I don't know, there's probably about 25, 30 journalists, senior journalist editors in the room, saying this is the year when something's going to go crack in the markets. Could be a number of different things that might cause that. And then somebody said, well, so if this is the case, Mr. Fuld, what are you doing about it to protect your own bank? He said, we're taking a few chips off the table, he replied. It wasn't true. They were still spending money on outrageously sized real estate deals right until weeks before the end. And it's really hard to square the statements that he made in such moments with the strategy that was being obviously pursued by the bank especially in its core fixed income division.
I wonder if that was a lack of oversight or communication.
I think it was the court of King Dick. He was surrounded by, or had surrounded himself by, people who told him what he wanted to hear. And very often I heard, especially when I moved to New York to lead the forlorn communications effort there. It was like, how do we break this to Dick? Or we shouldn't tell Dick this. he didn't know what was going on in the bank. He'd had until the disaster started to strike with the second quarter loss in 2008. He relied too heavily on his number two, who was a guy who believed in growth at all costs. Who was on, had his foot on the gas. And if people questioned some of the valuations of key assets in the division that he oversaw, they would be either silenced or fired or moved sideways. Mm. So there was it was a sort of cover up, really.
Yeah, that's bad news.
Cover up at worst, but certainly a massive failure of risk management and compliance.
Yeah, and how close do you think we came to a total systemic collapse at that point?
Oh, we were there. I mean, I think that, if you look at how the US Treasury Secretary at the time, Hank Paulson, the former Goldman Sachs chief, handled it, I would not criticize the decision to let Lehman go, but I would criticize the manner in which it happened. I think people with hindsight would say there were more orderly ways of winding down Lehman than just throwing it onto the rocks.
Yeah.
And so that action that created panic in the markets.
Yeah.
And you mentioned AIG. I mean, they were next in line, and they had to be bailed out where Lehman had not been. And that was a very, very costly exercise. But if AIG had not been bailed out, then the whole system would have fallen over. And it was around the same time that money market funds were losing their value, were breaking the buck, which was an unheard of situation. So you were only days away from people forming large and disorderly lines at bank cash machines to get their money out.
Yeah. And then if people couldn't get credit, supply chains would begin collapsing.
It would have been a deep freeze.
Yeah. Okay. It's very difficult to imagine how close we were, even though I lived through it, you know, kind of.
Well, there was things like, I mean, you know, I was just rereading the account of it by Barack Obama, who's written a very sort of long and interesting memoir of his time as president, or first volume of. And it was, you know, when Congress could not agree to the Bush proposed rescue plan, that was a moment of, you thought, the world was about to end, as we knew it. By that time, I'd gone off and decided to sit in the south of France watching the trees turn autumnal shades. I'd had enough, really. But I'd switched on the news for about 10 minutes every evening. That was all I allowed myself. And it was like distant noises of a system about to fall over.
Yeah.
And then I went back to watching the trees.
Yeah. Probably for the best. I mean, that's all we would have been able to do had the system fallen over anyway. Okay, so understandably after that, you decided to do something a little more solid and join a more solid company. So you moved to BP, but that didn't quite work out as well.
Well, that was the one I really regret having taken on, because I think there was so much wrong with the way BP was being led at the time and the position it was therefore in to handle the accident that happened 9 months after I joined. It was a complete nightmare, and this was a company that had grown very fast under its previous chief executive. It had adopted one might say progressive stances on things like global warming. Adopted the slogan Beyond Petroleum. The only problem is that the reality of what they were doing and how they were investing didn't justify these kind of slogans. So it was a company with a kind of cognitive dissonance about its purpose. And then the next chief executive, Tony Hayward, came in, and he was more focused on bringing it back to the reality of it was an oil company and an engineering company, and we needed to focus on that. But the communication effort was not in a position to match what was actually happening in reality.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that it was a company that had been, it was more than a coincidence that had various accidents. It was accident prone.
Yeah.
It had had the falling out in Moscow over TNK-BP. It had had a series of environmental problems in its operations in Alaska. It had had major clashes with the regulatory authorities over the safety of the Texas City refinery, and shenanigans on the oil futures market. So it was, you know, you look at that record and you think, this is a company that should be focusing quite a lot more on a concerted effort to manage its reputation and get to the roots of the problems these revealed. It was not doing that. It was still barreling ahead with a series of assets of varying quality, and it had not, frankly, rolled out the sort of top engineering operational quality guidebook as had, for example, Exxon, which is undisputed arbiter of excellence in that sphere. BP wanted to get like that, but it wasn't pursuing it nearly as centrally as you might expect.
Yeah.
So then, when a Deepwater Horizon comes along, they were really in a very poor starting point from which to deal with that disaster. Yeah. And the deaths and the destruction that it wrought.
So where were you when you found out, and what went through your head? I mean, you're only a few months into the job.
Yeah, I was walking across Trafalgar Square on my way into the office. It was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and I got a call from a colleague in the Houston press office. I saw my phone come up with a Houston number at
7 o'clock
in the morning. There would be 1 o'clock Houston time. I thought, this probably isn't good. And it was the news that there'd been this explosion, that some people, unknown number, had died. And, the thing was gushing oil into the water. And the full dimension of it, of course, was not completely clear at the time. But the reaction in head office when I went in there and sat with the senior management was, it was sort of paralysis, shock and paralysis. And it kind of rapidly became clear that there was no playbook to handle this. Now, I don't mean that in you could prepare in detail for something for this specific event, but for a major event in which senior management would have to take radical and rapid action, there had been no rehearsal and no even notional preparation for that. So it really was a case of floundering and making it up as we went along.
Yeah, now this is interesting. This is a topic I wanted to briefly touch on just before we finished as well, is crisis communications. And I'm quite interested in this balance between planning and improvisation. Obviously, no plan works perfectly, and yet you can't completely improvise. So what is, from a communications point of view, perhaps our area of expertise, what is the solution to that problem?
Well, I would start by comparing what I discovered to be BP's complete lack of preparation for a major corporate crisis in which senior management were going to be on point. And peer company Shell, as I understand it, they have had twice yearly crisis management exercises involving different parts of senior management with a view to, you know, establishing some basic codes of practice or operational habits that could be then rolled out without even thinking about it at a time like this. BP didn't have that. It had a, what are we going to do now? Why has this happened? It's all unfair. And the mindset, you know, if you don't have it ingrained that there's certain basics that you need to do when communicating in a crisis, you're inevitably going to be making mistakes. The biggest mistake you can make, I think, based on that experience and other things I've observed, is appearing to evade responsibility or try and push responsibility on someone else. The very first action that Tony Hayward authorized in communications terms, or asked to be done in communications terms when that disaster struck, was to issue a press release, which was simply a link to a press release that came from Transocean, the operator of the rig, reporting what had happened. And that the mood music or the signaling of that was to say, this is on them. It was never going to be on them, or certainly not solely on them. It was going to be on BP, which was the owner and architect of the well. And so that was it was just one day, very early on, but it was a sort of, it indicated a habit of thought that was not going to be was not going to be equal to the event.
No, and did you need to push back on that as well?
I probably should have done, would have done with hindsight, but it was just a situation that was so rapidly moving, and the decision making was being centered on one person, and that unfortunately continued. And you know that Tony Hayward was probably the least equipped person to deal with this in terms of, there are good things to do. There are things you have to do. You have to go to the place where the accident has happened, or the and in that territory, take on responsibility and say in effect, apologize. And he did that, and that was necessary and good. The problem was that he then appointed himself, and as I understand it, with pretty much single-handedly decided that he was going to be the leader of the crisis. This is a global, you know, this is a CEO of a global company with operations in all corners of the world, effectively lashing himself to, and you know, I'm not impugning his motives in doing so. They were. This is my responsibility to sort this out.
Yep.
But it's still an erroneous decision for a global CEO to appoint himself, as it were, chief operating officer of a crisis. He should have said sorry and then appointed somebody very credible to run the crisis, including the communications aspects of the crisis, and that would have been, as chance and irony would have it, Bob Dudley, who was an American national, ended up succeeding him when he had to resign over the disaster after the well was capped.
So you now, in your semi-retirement, advise companies on their reputation management from time to time when it's interesting enough.
Yeah.
Where and how could people contact you if they wanted to get your consultation?
I'm on LinkedIn. That's probably the best way. I mean, to be fair, I am more of my efforts now are dealing with producing content for companies. One of the largest management consultancies, I've done quite a lot of work in generating and editing reports for them. That's the kind of thing I like because it can be done down the line. Mm. It doesn't have. One thing I'm determined never to do again is to be placed in a position where I have to manage a crisis. I feel very happy to have spent 6 years working at Trafigura at the end of my full-time career because that was a company that genuinely wanted to improve its reputation, which was a pretty terrible place when I started. And they gave me a blank sheet of paper to work with and you know, come up with a plan and we'll implement it kind of thing, which was good. When I joined, I remember going around saying, well, I was present at Lehman Brothers when they went bust, and I was at BP when Deepwater Horizon happened, and everybody said, oh my God, what's going to happen to us? you're a harbinger of doom. I said, no. Trafigura has already had its disaster. We're here to rebuild and learn from others' mistakes. So it was quite empowering in that sense. But I don't want to do it any of that again. So I'm more really focused now on how companies can project the meaning of what they do or the purpose of what they do. And I don't mean in sort of terms of sort of greenwashing, but more dealing in substance with the issues that companies now have to deal with, such as, you know, how do we get to net zero?
Yeah.
How should we approach carbon markets and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. Well, we are out of time. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, and hope to talk to you again at some point in the future.
Thank you very much, Fergus. Great pleasure.
So that's it for this episode of the Copywriters Cupboard podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate, you know, there's plenty of other stuff you could have been doing with your time, and there's lots of other content options available. So genuinely, thank you very much. It's obviously very early days for the podcast. That was just episode 3. What I'm hoping to do moving forward is to, you know, we have the opportunity just through the nature of what we're doing to speak to a huge variety of people. So it doesn't just have to be copywriters, as you've seen already. We are going to talk to some copywriters in the traditional advertising sense and content writers, which is actually more what I do in my job. But there's also the opportunity to talk to poets, playwrights, you know, screenwriters, songwriters, authors, academic writers, report writers. There's tons we can learn from all of these people if we bring their collective knowledge together. And what's really exciting is we don't need to get, you know, too technical about it. We can enjoy listening to it because we can talk about a huge variety of topics as well. As you saw already, we've spoken to Scott Poynton in episode 1 about sustainability, particularly forests. Episode 2, we discussed the power of storytelling through Ruan McFadden's effort to revitalize an extinct Irish sport. And today we went through effectively the career bio of one of Britain's top journalists in Andrew Gowers. So we have a huge scope. We can get into business, we can get into marketing, but we can also get into art, we can get into psychology, we can get into sport. There is a ton of stuff that we can look at and pin it back into writing. So we've got a really interesting scope going forward. So please subscribe would be my first suggestion, so you can automatically see what's coming up. And if you enjoyed it, I'd be really very grateful if you could share it with someone. Tell a friend about it, tell a colleague, share it on social media, because that will really help me gain traction and get started. Obviously, we're very early days, but if you did enjoy it, I'd be really grateful if you would do that for me. So thank you very much. Looking forward to having you back again for our next episode. See you back next time.